Yep, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Ross, Judge Smith, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. And welcome to the Court of Appeals by Zoom. our first case this morning is In Re, the determination of the need for an EIS for the Nolte Family Irrigation Project. We have multiple relators, but it's my understanding, Ms. Konopacki, will you be the sole person arguing for the relators?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. And then Mr. Farrell, obviously, you'll be representing the department.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, as all parties are aware, we are doing this by Zoom. Our court rules prohibit anyone from recording this individually. The matter is, obviously, there will be an audio recording of this at the conclusion of the hearing that I think is available within 24 hours. Finally, as all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, the respondent will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, Ms. Konopacki, if you could just begin and just tell us who you are and allow your voice, please.
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jamie Konopacki, and I represent relators in this case, Kathy Connell, Environmental Working Group, Minnesota Well Owners Organization, Northern Water Alliance, and Toxic Taters. Your Honors, in this case, we're challenging the DNR's failure to order the legally required environmental review for a 303-acre irrigation project in a highly vulnerable area of the Pineland Sands. I'd like to be the first to acknowledge that I have a deferential standard of review to overcome in this case, Your Honors, but there are instances where you have reversed agency decisions because they are legally erroneous and unsupported in the record, and we would respectfully submit that this should be one of those cases. A case in point, Your Honors, is nearly 30 years ago in Trout Unlimited. This court ordered an EIS for a proposed irrigation project that was one-third the size of the site at issue in this case. There are three glaring reasons why we feel this court should reverse the DNR's negative declaration, order an EIS, and rescind prematurely issued irrigation permits. First, Your Honors, pumping 100 million gallons per year from leaky connected aquifers poses immediate and significant threats of harm to surrounding residential wells, the Red Eye River, and hundreds of acres of wetlands. Second, poorly evaluated chemical application poses a potentially significant cancer risk, as well as lethal harm to pollinators and aquatic invertebrates. And third, approval of this project without evaluation as a phased action threatens significant environmental effects covering at least 7,000 acres of the Pineland Sands. Given our limited time this morning, I'd like to focus on the project's potentially significant water depletion and water quality effects and the issue of phased action.
Council, may I just ask one preliminary question? Have permits already issued? Is that what you were saying?
They have.
All right, thanks.
So getting back to water quantity, Your Honors, the unknown and potentially significant depletion effects in this case standing alone clearly require an EIS. First, the record reflects that the agency has zero or insufficient information to evaluate the well interference risk for 18 private wells surrounding the project site. Second, DNR has not evaluated aquifer safe yield or the potentially significant effects to the Red Eye River and surrounding wetlands. Contrary to DNR's assertion, Your Honors, relators are not manufacturing assessment requirements. The agency's own aquifer test report, the agency's expert statements, the EAW development statements and declaration statements, as well as the EAW determination and previous EAW determinations all confirm what relators are saying, that there is additional aquifer testing that is necessary that should be completed during the environmental review process and prior to full site operation. I would point you to AR-19, where there is 8 comments from the agency identifying the need for more testing, as well as to the agency's previous statements in 2013, where they stated specifically that while irrigation permits require this type of testing, Your Honors, it should be completed during the EAW process in order to disclose all the potential related project impacts. So in essence, DNR is not denying potentially significant water depletion effects, the need for more information, or its ability to obtain the information, Your Honors. They're relying solely on an erroneous interpretation of MEPA 116D.04 sub 15. However, their statutory interpretation should be rejected because it is at odds with MEPA and this court's decisions in both Trout and Pope, which do not allow the agency to defer the necessary testing until the end of the first irrigation season.
Can you spell that out a little bit more? I mean, I know you're referencing, I mean, there's so many facts here, so
absolutely.
I apologize for catching up here, but when you say that the agency relied on a misunderstanding of the statute that you cite, can you flesh that out, please, a little bit?
Absolutely. So sub 15, Your Honor, says that to the extent practicable and so as not to conflict with other requirements of this section. And what we're saying is that you have to determine potentially significant effects. And in order to determine potentially significant effects, you need to look at the type, extent, and reversibility. And so when you have an irrigation case specifically, to determine the type, extent, and reversibility of impacts, you have to adequately pump and test those aquifers. That's how you determine the type, extent, and reversibility of potential effects, in this case, to dozens of surrounding residential wells and the wetlands and the Red Eye River.
What specifically, counsel, are you saying that they needed to do, and why? I mean, because I think that we will hear from respondent that there was testing that that you're arguing for, but there was testing that included, is it one well,
correct.
One so well, and then modeling relative to the others. Why isn't that something that's within the agency's discretion to determine the appropriate?
So while they did test one well, Your Honor, they state 7 times in their own aquifer test report at page 2, 11, 22, 23, 24, and 26, that the testing they completed is not sufficient to evaluate safe yield. So there's 2 connected aquifers, the shallower superficial aquifer. They can't establish safe yield, which is defined as the amount of water that can be withdrawn without significant ecological consequences. So they state first in their own test that they don't have sufficient information. And then second, Your Honors, they state 7 times that they need to do additional testing again of that separate aquifer. They've only pumped 1 out of 2 connected aquifers in order to evaluate the impacts to the Red Eye River and the wetlands. So DNR themselves is saying that they need more information. And what we're saying is this is a 1-week test. It should be completed before this concurrent pumping is happening. They've evaluated one well, they haven't pumped both wells, and they themselves have stated 7 times, 18 times total in the record, that this information is insufficient for them to evaluate risks.
Disabuse me if you can of my impression that perhaps you're arguing more for a challenge to a discretionary application of the statute as opposed to the legal question of the interpretation of the statute.
I would say that we're not, Your Honor. Again, the MEPA regulation is very clear that you have to evaluate the type, extent, and reversibility. That's 4410.1700 sub 7. And DNR has stated in its own record of decision that they cannot evaluate in quotes, the potential for and degree of effects on the Red Eye River and nearby wetland. So that's almost verbatim them saying that they cannot apply the statute as required to determine the potential significant effects to the Red Eye River and to the wetlands. And again, Your Honors, it's not just that aquifer test. I would direct you to AR 77, which the agency clearly states that prior to operating a project such as this, they need to pump all of the wells individually and together. And until they do that, they cannot evaluate site-specific risk. Until they do it, there's going to be an interim, immediate threat of harm when they operate this site at full capacity.
And that record site is not by number, but by description. What is that when you're saying they said?
That's the 2013 EAW determination, Your Honor.
The
when
EAW.
They were weighing in on Cass County's EAW. They made very clear that type of testing was required. And again, that is
echoed. The 2013 EAW?
Correct.
Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah. And in AR-19, Your Honor, in the development of this test, the same hydrogeologist that wrote the report stated 8 times that they needed to pump the wells individually and together. And she also stated that without that information, they really can't tell, as our expert also stated, whether they're going to be pulling all of the water out of the drinking water aquifer and that's directly out of the river and the wetlands, or whether they're going to be pulling from that other buried aquifer. So we don't know whether we're mining deeper aquifers or going to be immediately pulling from the superficial aquifer. And that's a really big unknown, potentially significant effect to defer.
I seem to recall, at least, and perhaps I'm wrong, one of Mr. Farrell's responses, well, you know, that was a different project and this is a more narrow one. So why is he wrong?
So if they were approximately the same acreage, the 2013 project and this project, Your Honor. And in this case, I would say that if you look at the aquifer test itself, the threat of harm is more clear based on the preliminary testing in this case. If you go to the aquifer test, it's at page 22, They state that the 2-foot water rise in the river that they observed, that they visually observed during testing, was immediately visible in the untested aquifer on this site. So they know there's direct connectivity to the river in this case, and they didn't have that in that other case. So I would say the unknown risk in this case is actually greater. The project is potentially the same magnitude. It's about 300 acres, but the risk here is very clearly identified. And that potentially significant risk needs to be evaluated under the clear regulations and the statutes prior to operation of this site. It's wholly insufficient to do what the DNR is suggesting in this case, which is a use season test. Essentially, they're going to let the permittee pump for the entire irrigation season and only then go back and evaluate risks. And as I've just stated, if a 2-foot rise in the river was immediately visible and in that shallower aquifer, the implications for going the other direction, pulling down by 80 or 90 feet this aquifer, that's an immediate risk to the river and to the connected wetlands.
Ms. Konopke, I was wondering, since you're sort of running out of time, if you wanted to talk a little bit about the phased action portion of your appeal.
I would, Your Honor. Thank you. So pivoting then to the phased action, DNR makes three main arguments here: that the action was abandoned long ago, that it's too speculative to be considered, and that the link between Ardiofit and Nolte has been severed. And we argue firmly that none of that is supported in the record, Your Honors. First of all, if you look at AR 62 and 64, the record clearly states that DNR has issued 5 permits since the initial consideration of the entire project. And in addition to that, RDO has continued to apply for permits that have not been issued and worked throughout that time period with Mr. Nolte on applying for these permits. So clearly RDO has not abandoned the action. Again, DNR has admitted this in 2018, July of
2018. Ms. Konopke, here's my question. So as I understand it, you know, you believe that this is all sort of a sham on behalf of, the French fry company, and that at some point, Mr. Nolte is going to start growing potatoes, which he's not supposed to do. I mean, if that happens, presumably that would violate the permit and the permit could be pulled. I mean, why isn't that an adequate remedy if you truly believe that, you know, this is all a sham?
Yeah. So, Your Honor, the issue here is, again, the phased action in its entirety and the slow death by 1,000 cuts. So it isn't just this project in and of itself. It's the need to evaluate all of these projects collectively. And we've made clear here that the nature of the project is not speculative, that we have 54 site-specific actions, and that Mr. Nolte is clearly working with RDO and does intend to grow potatoes. And the immediate effects from those impacts and the inability to address them through the permit process is what I was talking about with water quantity usage and water quality, Your Honor. Those impacts are going to happen to the private residential well owners and to the surface water resources immediately in this case. And so if I can pivot back actually in the last few minutes and address those immediate water quality impacts and why I feel the permit would be insufficient to address the same. We have in the record here Dr. Kraft's site-specific analysis, which DNR, as we point out, has wholly failed to address, which constitutes further legal reversible error in this case. And Dr. Kraft's modeling analysis points out that under the best case scenario, ignoring 720 tons of manure that Mr. Nolte plans to apply, the project is going to cause groundwater contamination 2 to 4 times the Safe Drinking Water Act limit, Your Honors. And Dr. Kraft further concluded that water is going to discharge into the abutting Red Eye River and wetlands. And it extends again beyond. So in the trout case, we had mostly impacts to surface water resources. In this case, we have nearly 3 dozen private residential wells. And especially if you look at figure 7 in our reply brief, Kathy Connell's neighboring private wells, which have been demonstrated to be immediately vulnerable to the nitrate contamination that Dr. Kraft has predicted will occur at this site. So if you look at the record, there's simply no evidence to support the agency makes this generalized assertion that Ms. Connell's wells and other wells will not be contaminated with unsafe risks of nitrate contamination. But the record reflects that they don't have any support for that contention. When the Environmental Review Unit asked the hydrogeologist who had performed the aquifer test, completed those specifications, the hydrogeologist, made very clear that they didn't know whether these wells were going to be immediately contaminated. And further, DNR officials stated that they didn't know how they could remediate that contamination through their permitting authority. So not only do we have immediate water quantity and water quality risks on the site that can't be addressed through permitting authority, this is a clear indication that RDO is continuing to implement this larger phased action, and it needs to be addressed as such. You know, these permits aren't public.
So can I ask, all right, so, and again, my apologies if this should be evident to me, but there are some permits already issued. If and I think that, I assume that the potential harm that you're talking about is if the land is converted into use for potato production, right?
Industrial potato production, correct.
Industrial potato production. Is there, is consistent with the department's rulings to date, is there any, is Mr. Nolte free to do that? And are there free to convert all of that acreage into industrial potato production without further need for permits?
The permits have already been issued, Your Honor. So they deforested, and part of the issue in this case is that DNR has repeatedly told them to deforest before applying for the permit. So the land has been deforested. He has permits and he is ready to roll out the irrigation equipment this spring.
And for potato farming. And there's nothing, no conditions in the permits you're saying that would preclude him from doing that.
Correct. And those permit fact sheets are at the record 213 to 215. So with that, I'll.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Konopacki. You will have a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Farrell, we'll now hear from the department, please.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. This court should affirm the DNR's decision to issue a negative declaration on the need for an environmental impact statement related to the Nolte project. Relators advance two main arguments on appeal. First, the relators argue that the Nolte project is effectively a sham, and it's really connected to an already off-it 7,000-acre expansion project. The problem for relators is that that already off-it project was abandoned years ago. And even if it weren't, this project does not meet the other requirements for a phased action, as that term is defined by rule. Now, I want to note at the outset that the DNR acknowledges and shares the relators' broader concerns about the effects from irrigated agriculture in this region of central Minnesota. And those concerns were reflected in attachment F to the EAW. It's in the record at index number 75. It comprehensively walks through them. But that does not mean that there's a basis to foist the costs of region-wide environmental review on Mr. Nolte. Second, relators challenged the merits of the DNR's determination that the Nolte project, a small agricultural project, is not likely to have significant environmental effects. They focus on purported inadequacies in local water quality and quantity and pesticide drift effects. But the record overwhelmingly shows that the DNR took a hard look at each of these issues. And the record overwhelmingly shows that each of these issues is within the core of the DNR's technical and substantive expertise. Consistent with the deferential standard of review that this court applies to EIS determinations, there's no reason to disturb the DNR's decision here. Let me turn first to what I think is fair to say that was the primary focus of the briefing, and then I'll shift focus to some of the topics that.
You know, before you do that, I would just like to ask two questions. One is I'd like to follow up on Judge Smith's excellent question. I mean, as these permits stand now, can Mr. Nolte grow potatoes on this property?
Well, I think the important thing to clarify is under the permits, he's allowed to appropriate, under the three permits collectively, he's allowed to appropriate up to 100 million gallons a year. Now, Mr. Nolte has represented that potatoes are just one part of a five-year crop rotation that's in the EAW. I think it's important to understand. Is there a restriction in the permit on what he can farm? The answer to that question is no. But in terms of what Mr. Nolte has represented, his plan is, it is not to grow potatoes.
I think he said it was none of your business, as I recall. That was his sort of... but anyway, well, you've answered the potato question, which, you know, that's a new one for me. I was wondering, one of the amicus briefs has dealt with the pesticide effect on the pollinators. I was wondering, and that was highlighted in the reply brief, I was wondering if you could tell us where we should look both, well, in the decision that the DNR made that would give us confidence that you dealt with that issue.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me talk. So pollinators were specifically discussed in the EAW in multiple places. So and specifically, they were discussed in paragraphs 12C, 13C, 16C, and 19A. And in the context of the record of decision, which responded to the comments that were made on the EIW and including comments about risks to pollinators, there is a discussion in the environmental effects section in paragraph 35. And I also believe in paragraph 32, there is a general discussion about risks to wildlife and habitat. The bottom line conclusion in the record of decision is that, you know, given the small size of the project, the mitigation controls that are in place, the impacts to wildlife species in general and pollinators specifically are likely to be negligible. And so I don't think it's fair for the amici or the relators in their briefs to say that this issue wasn't considered by the DNR. It's more robust.
And I'd like you to return to that, but does that assume that those decisions assume that all of the acreage at issue will be farmed for potatoes? I guess I'm trying to figure out, like, why does it matter if he said he's not going to do it, if he's free to do it? Should the decision relative to an EIS and the concerns about environmental effects be based on the presumption that he will do it if there's no reason that he wouldn't, or nothing stopping him, I guess, from farming only potatoes from now on?
Right. Well, I guess I'd answer the question this way, Your Honor, which is the decision on whether this project has the potential for significant environmental effects assumed that Mr. Nolte would be using the land for irrigated agriculture. I don't think the decision depends on the particular crop that he's planning to grow, because the water quality and water quantity concerns that, you know, the relators are specifically focused on are really tied to, you know, nutrient management practices, runoff, et cetera, that, you know, aren't necessarily tied to the specific crop that he is going to grow. So there's a lot of focus on potatoes, I think, in particular, because relators allege that this project is part of a phased action with Artie Offit. So I don't think that it really changes the analysis, because
just that I'm clear, to again follow up on Judge Smith's question. So these pesticides, it's not like if he's growing potatoes, there's a really more toxic pesticide he would use. Your analysis just did with whatever pesticides he's gonna using to grow his crops, you know, it's not a problem. I mean, is that sort of the bottom line? I mean, there's not some super triple X death pesticide that you use to keep bugs off potatoes. Is that right?
You know, my understanding, Your Honor, is within the EAW, Attachment D lists all the pesticides that he would use depending on his particular crop rotation, including potatoes. And the DNR and the interagency team that looked at the potential effects that were tied to the uses of those pesticides determined that their impacts were likely to be negligible. They were not likely to have significant environmental effects. And I just want to reiterate for the court that if you just even, you know, look at the EAW and control F for the word pesticide, you're going to see an extensive discussion of the potential effects that are tied to pesticide use. You're going to see the same thing in the record of decision. There was a very close examination of what the potential environmental impacts tied to Mr. Nolte's agricultural practices would be. And that's within the core of the DNR's technical and factual expertise. And that's what the Minnesota Supreme Court said in the key precedents in this area. And I really urge the court to look at the MCA case, where it says, the question of whether environmental effects are significant is primarily a factual inquiry that depends on the agency's application of its expertise to the facts presented. That's in the MCA decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2002. It's primarily a factual inquiry. And here you had a robust team of interagency reviewers looking at the potential effects associated with this. You had MDH, you had MDA, you had MPCA, and all of them concluding that the effects from this project were likely to be negligible. And so I think it's important.
Is a pesticide drift issue, because there was an amicus brief and then there's also the relators brief, et cetera. And then looking at the EAW and ROD, is the drift issue solely a water issue? Is it also an air issue? It seems like there was also a pollination question about like actually pollinators being harmed by actually, by potato crops themselves, right? Pollinating because of the seeds, I think, et cetera. I'm trying to figure out where the pesticide issue lies and where, and then how the department addressed it.
I think it lies in multiple places, and that's why it's addressed in multiple places in the EAW and the ROD. So for example, the pesticide issue, it does present some water quality and water resource concerns. So it's discussed in paragraph 11 of the EAW. It also presents some air concerns. So it's discussed in paragraph 16 of the EAW. I believe that's the paragraph that deals with air. For that very reason, it's also discussed in multiple places in the ROD, right? Paragraph 27 deals with health impacts. Pesticides are discussed in that portion of the ROD. They're also discussed extensively in the cumulative potential effects analysis, which is in, discussed in multiple places in the ROD, but paragraph 24, and then also in the effects section in paragraph 35. So the pesticide issue was considered in a number of different ways by the DNR and what the potential impacts might be. And again, the question here is not whether there are no effects. The question is whether those effects are likely to be significant. That's the actual factual inquiry that the DNR was making. MEPA doesn't prescribe that the agency is necessarily, it doesn't put a thumb on the scale. It's an information disclosure statute. And so the question before this court is whether the DNR took a hard look at that issue. I think the record overwhelmingly shows that it did. I'd like to briefly just address two key points that I think Ms. Konopacki raised that I'd be remiss if I didn't address that argument today. So first of all, just on the RDOFIT point, because it is a tremendous focus of their briefing, I just want to underscore for the court that there's no legal basis for the remedy that they are proposing. They're saying that this court should order a third party, a non-party to this appeal, to pay for region-wide environmental review. When that third party is saying it abandoned that project years ago. Now, in their reply brief, they say, well, no, we don't want RDO to pay for it. We want Mr. Nolte to pay for it. There's no legal support for that. Their citation is to a portion of their comment letter, which just basically says that RDOFIT should pay for this. So on that RDOFIT point, I think the court should dismiss that aspect of the appeal. On the merits, Ms. Konopacki's argument focused mostly today on the aquifer test and the assessment issue. I want to be really clear here. What MEPA requires, what Subdivision 16 requires, is an assessment of water resources. It does not say that an aquifer test is required in each and every case. And so I think in terms of the point that Judge Ross made, the argument here is really about the DNR's discretionary decision about timing. And, the DNR determined that it could do an assessment of water resources for purposes of the EAW without an aquifer test. And if you look at the EAW, there are multiple United States geologic surveys, regional aquifer data, other data discussed that the DNR used to do that assessment for purposes of the EAW. For purposes of permitting, the DNR did require an aquifer test. And so what relators' complaints really boil down to are complaints about the design of the tests and the specific recommendations that are within the test. And I think it's notable this morning that a couple times Ms. Konopacki said that the permit is insufficient to address the issues that are identified in the report or some variation of that. There was no appeal of the permits. Relators absolutely could have appealed the permits on the merits. They didn't do so. What they have done is challenge the environmental review component of this project. And that That appeal really turns on whether the DNR took a hard look at the water quality, water quantity, and pesticide issues that they focus on. And the record overwhelmingly shows that to be the case. Specifically on water quantity, because the aquifer test was done before the environmental review process was completed, the recommendations from that test were incorporated into the record of decision. Specific, targeted, enforceable permit conditions are included in the record decisions. And DNR's environmental review team confirmed that those conditions could be incorporated into the permits. So I really think that focus that relators have tried to shift course, recognizing that there are some real issues in terms of the standard of review here. And they're focusing on what they allege to be deficiencies in the aquifer test itself. But if they didn't think that the conditions that came out of the test or those conditions that were flagged in the record decision were sufficient, they absolutely could have gone and challenged the permits. They didn't do that here.
So counsel, when I look at the concluding paragraph of the relator's brief, the remedies that they request, they ask at the end, if the court reverses the DNR's negative declaration, relators further request that it order DNR to rescind irrigation permits. Speak to me about whether that is a remedy that you think is available relative to the permits. Or does it follow naturally from if we were to reverse the negative declaration?
I do think that's a remedy that's available, Your Honor, but typically in these cases, not always, but typically, there's two challenges. There's one to the environmental review component, and there's one to the permit itself. I mean, PolyMet's just an obvious example that comes to mind, right? Like usually if you have an issue with the substantive conditions, you know, you're not just gonna rest your whole case on the environmental review component here. I think it's just telling that the relators have not actually challenged the permit conditions themselves. I see that my time has expired. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll rest on my brief. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Counsel for relator, you will have the last word, please.
You're muted, I believe.
Thank you. With respect to the remedies, we agree that they are appropriate in this case. And relators did request information on permit issuance from the agencies, which was never provided. Unlike factory farm permits and other types of permits, which are publicly issued, and the public has notice and an opportunity to appeal, MPARS works very differently, which is, I think, why that particular remedy is appropriate in this case. Respecting the aquifer testing, we're not shifting. As I stated at the opening, there's a lot of issues in this case. And these issues weigh equally in the minds and the hearts of the people that live around this project area. This is not a farmland, a farm project located in the middle of nowhere. It is in the middle of wetlands, a river, and surrounded by 15 residences, Your Honors. And in that respect, you know, we had to focus here at Oral Argument. The aquifer test and the water quality concerns, both the water depletion and the water quality concerns, again, we're not asking for a battle of the experts here. We're asking the agency to consider their own determinations in light of the MEPA requirements. MEPA requires more than kind of the general statement that counsel provided. It says if there is information that is necessary to understand potentially significant effects but lacking, that information is required to be obtained under MEPA as part of the environmental review process. Pope, Trout, in addition, Judge Connolly, your decisions in MNTAC and Friends make clear that there is a clear distinction between relying on concrete mitigation and relying on after the fact regulatory oversight. They're taking a wait and see approach, and it's dangerous in this case, Your Honors. If you look at AR 213, which is the permit fact sheet for the Northern Well, it makes very clear that they are not going to further evaluate these potentially significant depletion effects to wells, rivers, and wetlands, which they have made clear again in their own aquifer test that they need more information on. They're not going to revisit that issue until the end of the first irrigation season. It's a one-week test, Your Honors, a one-week test that could prevent, you know, irreparable damage to streams and to wetlands, as DNR itself has pointed out in AR 77 in a previous case, as DNR itself points out in AR 19 in this case. A one-week test, Your Honors, to protect all of the residents surrounding this project and to protect irreversible harm to water resources. information that DNR admits that it needs, information that is clearly required under 4410.1700 sub 2A. Similarly, with respect to the water quality concerns, MEPA has a specific requirement. There needs to be a specific response to the water quality concerns that we addressed. Dr. Kraft just didn't come in and write a general comment in this case. He provided an expert analysis. He is the foremost expert on the issue of nitrate leaching beneath irrigated cropland in this country. He went through and evaluated the crop rotation. This isn't just about potatoes. It is clear that potatoes require more nitrate, and to your point, Judge Connolly, more fungicides and harmful pesticides and other types of crops. But that crop rotation was evaluated as a whole, as identified in the EAW itself. Dr. Kraft identified the best case scenario. We have nitrate contamination 2 to 4 times the Safe Drinking Water Act. That immediately threatens Kathy Connell's well. She's literally, again, if you look at figure 7, Kathy Connell's organic farm, her homestead that's been there for 30 years, Your Honors, is immediately at risk of nitrate contamination. And again, if you look in the record, their generalized statements about nitrate contamination not happening or not capable of being modeled are unsupported. The hydrogeologist from the DNR stated that they don't know whether private risk of contamination exists. They didn't evaluate that. That's in the record at AR 629 and in our briefs. And again, Steve Colvin at AR 757 from the DNR said, we don't know how we can mitigate that contamination if it does occur to Ms. Connell's wells through our permitting process. It's clear that the mitigation the mitigation measures that the DNR is relying on here cannot even be considered vague statements of good intention, Your Honors. They did identify those mitigation opportunities in the record of decision as well as in their aquifer test report. But again, if you look to the actual permit fact sheets in this record at AR 213 to 215, it reflects that they waived or ignored all of those requirements. They are not going to require alternate pumping. They've said that they won't pump the two southern wells at the same time, but the north and south well can still be pumped together. They have not even required Mr. Nolte to obtain the well information for his neighbor's wells. They're flying blindly with respect to their potential to impact neighbors in this case. And similarly, the water quality mitigation measures reflect that they never obtained the necessary site-specific information. DNR repeatedly asked, but never received a site-specific manure management plan or nitrate management plan. So, Your Honors, again, this is a case where we have a highly vulnerable site, several neighbors and water resources, and they're simply not being protected in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter was very well researched and briefed. We will issue our decision within 90 days.